welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and this is a very special edition of Garden Talk. We are broadcasting live from Bayfield in Bloom. Great to be here at the beautiful Bayfield Pavilion right on the shores of Lake Superior with some wonderful views here. The windows all around, and it's really a lot of fun to look out those windows and see the lake without any ice on it for the most part, which I'm told I was the one that brought the took the ice out when I arrived. They were ice fishing, I think, about a week ago, and now it's all open. And as I drove through Bayfield, I saw the daffodils, lots of wonderful daffodils to kind of kick off Bayfield in Bloom, which is a wonderful event. And we'll talk a bit about that event during the show, and we'll be taking some questions and comments from you as you listen in on the radio or for the wonderful audience that we have here. If you have a question, I hope you'll raise your hand, and Chris Molina, our producer, will be around to hand you a microphone so you can ask that question. And, well, who's going to be answering those questions? It's probably not me. I learned a few things on Garden Talk, but I'm not nearly as smart as the two guys that are with me today. Jason Fishbach, the University of Wisconsin Extension Agricultural Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. Jason, great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Welcome back to Bayfield.
Yeah, wonderful to have you back. Always great to see Don Kissinger as well. Don, Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Don, great to see you as well.
Yeah, it was great. Yesterday I was able to come up and I stopped in Tomahawk and then Washburn and did some Arbor Day presentations and then got up here last night, so it was good.
I had a lot of fun too. I broadcast yesterday from Wausau and that was a lot of fun. And we had a nice event in Ashland last night and now we got this wonderful event here today. And as you listen in today again, I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on my Ideas Network Facebook page. And once I get my screen up so I can see where the calls are coming from, there we go. You know, Chris Molina is good for a lot of things. And one of the things he's really good at is fixing all my problems that develop during a particular show. You may have some problems developing with your plants, with your trees. I hope you'll join in with your own questions about them. Jason, Bayfield in Bloom. What's blooming this time of the year around this part of the world?
Pretty much just daffodils.
Yeah. There are a lot of yellow ones.
Yeah, I was just up in the orchards here this morning, and, you know, those apple blossoms are still hiding. There's the May 26 apple blossom run and ride, and with the forecast, maybe we'll see some color then. But it's slow, as it is everywhere.
I really would like, you know, I'm going to be in Canada that day, so I'm not going to be able to go to it. I'd drive back up for that. It's 13-mile bike ride or a 3.5-mile bike ride, or you can run for a 10K or walk it. I probably run it and walk. I probably jog it and walk it, I guess is what I do. And a 2-mile run and walk. So that's May 26th. And that's just one of the many events that are going on here. I was looking, somebody was talking to me about the Birding and Nature Festival. That's May 17th through the 19th. And I looked through this, talk about things that are going on. Here we've got about a 30-pager. A 30-page book, and it's just full of all the different activities that are going to be going on. It's absolutely amazing. And there's open houses at Madeline Island and a whole lot more. If you go online to Bayfield and Bloom, you're going to find out, I think, pretty much all the events that are going on during the month of May. It'll be a lot of fun. Well, Don Kissinger, what are you hearing from people? What's the major concern, let's put it that way, out there this part of the state right now, or any part of the state for that matter?
Well, I've been hearing some concerns about gypsy moth because the spraying for the gypsy moth in this portion of the state is occurring, and then also because the state has been quarantined as of March 30th for emerald ash borer. It's a different dynamic than it used to be, which... Basically, lumber logs can be moved throughout the state, but we really don't want that to occur because it was a slow progressive movement. It was first found in 2008, and we just would like to keep it that way.
Yeah, it's and as a matter of fact, we have folks here dressed as a gypsy moth and a gypsy moth caterpillar and an emerald ash borer, and I had my picture taken with all three of them. And I think we're going to get that posted up on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And also, if you go to Twitter at L. Mealer Show, you're going to find those photos as well. And that's also another place where you want to tweet a question. You can go ahead and do that as well. You know what? We already have calls, and I'm sure this... holler at me or something so people can hear how many people are here. Give me a shout, audience. All right, you can tell there are a lot of people here. And they will have questions too, but let's take a call. Why don't we start with a call? Cliff in Fond du Lac, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, I have a question
in regard to Canadian cherry trees. We have several beautiful trees, both in Milwaukee and in Fond du Lac. And we have a problem, the healthier the tree, the more suckers we get. And I would like to know if there is a non-invasive way to prevent suckers from appearing.
I would think... Well, the first answer is no, there isn't really. But sometimes what can happen is if you're pruning out too many of the limbs and we get the sun hitting the trunk of the tree, then you start getting a profusion of limbs growing together. They're called latent or adventitious buds that then come out. So pruning too extensively can be a problem. Another thing I'd like to mention, you stated Canadian red cherries. A problem with that those trees do have is called black knot too, where there's a confluence of black stuff on it that kind of looks like dog crap. That basically that can stifle those limbs, and you have to cut that back. So that's at least in my neck of the woods in central and northern Wisconsin, I see that as a big problem with a lot of our Schubert or Canada red cherries that residents have.
Thanks for that, Don Kissinger. So Cliff, not the greatest news in the world, but he can just cut those off, can he?
Yes, you can, but the thing that you want to do is you want to make sure that where that fungus is, you want to cut back far enough. Typically, when you cut that limb and you look at a cross-section of it, it's going to be cream-colored or white-colored. That means that it's healthy. So if you see that it's kind of a dark profusion in there, that means that there's still some of that fungus. And when you do make that cut, probably you want to spray it with some Lysol with that pruning tool and then wipe that off when you make your next cut as well.
All right. Cliff, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's take another call. Let's go to Phil in Lake Geneva. Phil, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, gentlemen. I'm on the state line just below Lake Geneva in Illinois. My question is, I have some redbud trees that I grew from the seed trees that are at University of Wisconsin, which is their very hardy clone, and they're about 35 years old and 14 feet tall. And my question or asking for a comment on, about 3 years ago, we had what appeared to be a pretty strong outbreak of verticillium in the trees. They're fully exposed and not on any understory or protected. And we treated the trees by using a very light fertilization, and we used biostimulant products that we've used for 3 years in the root system. And it appears we've turned around the disease or at least stopped it from getting worse. Do you have any experience with that? And do you have any other suggestions on what we could do to help the trees?
Okay, I'm looking at my guests, Jason and Don. And Jason, do you want to
give it a shot? So did you have a positive identification on the verticillium wilt? Did you send in a sample or to get a diagnosis?
There was a lab test that came up positive on two of the four branches.
Okay, gotcha. So at that point, you know, there isn't a lot because it's inside the tree. So anything you can do to promote the health of the tree is a good thing. The biostimulants that the root applied, the concept is that you've got fungi or bacteria that are growing profusely and basically just take up all the space so that your pathogens can't grow. The data on how effective they are is mixed, but it certainly doesn't hurt anything. It could have been that, or more likely just the growing conditions turned around were more favorable. These root rot diseases or other moisture-related disease, if you've got good soil drainage, certainly is going to help. So light fertilization, nothing wrong with that. Just keep doing what you're doing if you've turned the corner on it, and you know, hope the tree can fight it off on its own.
Yeah. Phil, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Cudahy next and talk with Lee. Lee, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have two hydrangeas that are together, and every fall we put a screen around it, like a little fence, and we put dry leaves in there. Well, and they always come back on the dead branches. But now I took the leaves off about 2 weeks ago, and there's no green. It's just like they're dead.
Do you know what type of hydrangea? Is it a arborescens or a macrophylla? Do you know the variety name?
No, but it's like a bluish purple.
Okay. Generally, the hydrangeas, I don't think you need to be protecting them with the pile of leaves around the stems like you would, say, roses, for example. I would just leave those bare because what you're creating is some habitat for fungi. You're also creating a nice place for voles and other varmints to get in there. And my guess is that it wasn't winter injury, but instead, if you look at the base of the stem, see if you have any girdling. See if there was some chewing by voles over the winter. But in general, yeah, I would say you know save yourself the work. I don't think you need to protect those hydrangeas over the winter.
In the meantime,
I cut back the dead wood, and you might very well see some new growth here this spring.
Yeah,
it might take a little while, and it might be crown origin instead of from the branches, but give it a little time, clear out the leaves, prune out the dead stuff, and it should be okay.
That was one of the nice things I always thought about the hydrangeas, for me anyway. You didn't have to do a whole lot, anything really, to get them through the winter, which was kind of nice. Thank you very much for calling, Lee. Let's take a question from the audience. Give us your name and where you're from.
Okay, my name is Rick. I'm from Nakusa, central Wisconsin, up here enjoying the weather up here in Bayfield today.
Wonderful. What's on your mind today?
The question I have for your experts are, any recommendation for shrubs or trees that would provide food for birds and secondarily nectar for pollinators early in the season? Again, I'm in central Wisconsin.
Sure. A long list of plants for you. And I actually wrote some of these down, anticipating such a question, so great. First off, there's a great publication by Scott Craven. It's in our learning store, UW Extension Learning Store, called Landscape Plants That Attract Birds. And it does a great job of going through your trees, both deciduous and evergreen, goes through shrubs, goes through herbaceous plants, that tries to lay out a whole sequence of flowering plants for birds in particular. So. And he's definitely a fan of some of our berry-producing native plants. So these would be the viburnums. It could be highbush cranberry. It produces those red berries, or nanny berry. It's also a viburnum, produces the blackberries. Dogwoods, service berries, elderberry. So those would be some great, great shrubs. In terms of pollinator habitat for providing nectar, especially early in the season, you know, now's the time to pay attention and see what's flowering, identify those plants, and just plant more of them. So pussy willows, for sure, are some of the first to start to produce some nectar. Plums, cherries, the service berries that are blooming. Basswood trees, trying to lay out that sequence. And then at that point, most of your trees are done flowering. You can move into the herbaceous plants. Lupines, clovers, coneflowers, bergamot. So there's a long list, but if you start with that landscape plants that attract birds, on our extension website, that'd be a great place to start.
And you could probably talk to the folks at Dragonfly Gardens, they have a little booth right behind you there, as a matter of fact. And I know they have a lot of plants for sale today that are attractors of butterflies and other beneficials. So you can probably talk to them a little bit about it, too. They, just as an aside, Rob Bursk, who was one of the original native plant people here in Wisconsin unfortunately died in a tragic accident. And Dragonfly Gardens today is selling some of his plants, and are selling some plants in his memory. He was a great guy. I had him on the show, and we'll all miss his contribution to plants here in the state of Wisconsin. Anyway, as an aside, yeah. Thank you very much for that question. We'll take some more calls from our questions from the audience, but let's go back to the phones for a minute. Pat and Madison, been waiting a bit.
Hi, good morning.
Pat, what's on your mind?
Yes. First a comment and then a question. One is, you mentioned the plants from Wisconsin. Tomorrow is the Arboretum's native plant sale from 9 to 2 down here in Madison. And secondly, my question regards a rose plant that we have that's been in the backyard for 4 or so years, and I can't remember the variety anymore, and there's too much shade back there. We only get green foliage. So now a city tree fell down, and we have sunlight in the front, and I want to move the plant. How do I do that?
Jason?
Yeah, I think... if you don't have too much growth, and we're getting to that point where it's a little risky, but you could dig and move it this spring still. If you're worried about the plant going into shock, try to bring the soil with you. But it's probably best in the fall at this point, and you can dig it at that point almost bare root dormant, so you don't have to worry about taking so much soil with you. And then just transplant it and try to mulch it a little bit to try to keep the soil warm so those roots will grow more in the fall. And that's basically all there is to it. Water it in well and should be fine.
Yeah. Thanks very much for that call. Our guest today, Don Kissinger from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and Jason Fischbach, who is the county agricultural agent for, where is he from? He's with both Ashland and Bayfield counties. Our guests, along with a wonderful group of people here at the Bayfield in Pavilion to kick off Bayfield in Bloom. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Don Kissinger from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and Jason Fischbach, our guest as well, who can answer a whole variety of questions as well. He's the county ag agent for Ashland and Bayfield counties. We had an email from Mike in Algoma who says, I have a spruce planted in an old field, some are 30 feet tall and growing well. Other small trees grow to 5-6 feet, but then they die off. Needles die, and a half year later, the tree dies. No evidence of animal or physical damage. Any ideas? And I assume those are spruce as well. So these are young spruce coming in after the old ones have been doing pretty well.
I don't have a reason why that, especially, are they coming from the same seed source, or they're coming from the seeds from the larger?
Don't know.
Probably the way to handle this, and if they still have a couple of living ones or half dead ones, is to try to grab some of those leaf samples, the needles, before they're totally dead, but when they're not totally green either, and send those in for some diagnosis and see if they can isolate if it's a fungal leaf disease, you know, something like Rhizospheria, which is very common, but it usually doesn't kill the plant outright. It's more of an annual defoliation of last year's needles. But otherwise, you know, looking at some root pathogens, and generally, if that's the experience, it's a good idea. It's never a good idea to plant the same tree where you just took one out. The same species. So if you've had problems with spruce, time to try something different. You know, pine or cedar or even deciduous trees at that point.
Yeah.
So one thing to take a look at if you wanted to is typically Rhizospheria starts from the bottom up, and if you would get some of the needles, if the needles are actually falling off, and if he has something that he can microscope type thing to take a look at the underside, and if there are black dots there, that is Rhizosphera. So that would be
self-identification if you had a little microscope, or maybe even take it into the office, the extension office too.
Sure.
But I like Jason's idea too of just sending it into the plant disease diagnostic clinic, and they can probably give a pretty darn quick answer. So thanks for that email. You can email us too at ideas@WPR.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Give a call, 800-642-1234. And let's take another call. We have some open lines, by the way, so if you have a question, you can get on pretty quickly. Suzanne in Stoughton, you are up. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So,
what's on your mind today?
I'm wondering about planting berries. We bought this property mid-June last year, and it has 30 neglected landscaping beds. So we're kind of focused on that right now, but we want to establish some perennials and a little straw bale garden. And the soil is rather clay-like, and there's quite a bit of creeping charlie. So right now the lawn isn't really the priority, but we would like to establish some strawberries and then also some raspberry canes. And we have pretty much available like any sort of sun or shade or whatever on the property. My question, is would it be better to do like raised beds for the strawberries? Would it be, what I need to do, are there best practices for choosing a variety and establishing raspberry canes?
Okay, let's turn to Jason for that. Jason,
sure.
Fishbach?
So for the strawberries, strawberries and clay soil is not a good mix. So with the strawberries, for sure, do a raised bed and amend that soil, either with organic matter, with that native clay soil, or if you need to bring in some potting soil or find a sand source to make a nice blend. Because you really need well-drained soil for strawberries to thrive. Raspberries will do okay on the heavier clay. You can use, raised bed would be fine, but you can even just mound up the soil a little bit, kind of like a 12 or 6-inch windrow. Again, just to get some moisture away from those roots, excess moisture. And some of the older varieties actually have proven to do well, so Latham, Killarney. And I would definitely, these days in our era of spotted wing Drosophila, go for those, the earlier bearing strawberry varieties.
Yeah.
The sooner you can produce fruit, the less likely you'll get overrun by the spotted wing Drosophila. So I would just rule out the fall bearing entirely. Another fruit crop for you to consider, and anyone that's on clay, and I really want more people to learn to love currants, red currants in particular, the white currants, pink champagne. They do well on the clay. They don't get eaten by the deer, and they're really pretty easy to pick, and they bear about the same time as raspberries are ripened, so typically they're not preferred by the spotted wing Drosophila. So I know the flavor's not for everyone, but Europeans eat them by the bucket load, so why can't we, right?
Yeah. What's the flavor like?
It's tart.
Tart.
It's very tart. So the reds tend to be sweeter. It's not, you know, the black currants are definitely acquired taste, but, you know, black currant jam, or if you add enough sugar, they taste fine.
Yeah. I'm thinking honey.
Yeah.
Put a little honey in there. That would be a help. Good ideas. Thanks, Suzanne. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. John in Cedarburg, it is your turn. Hi, John.
Have a question. I've got a batch of small dwarf fruit apple trees, and I need to know, when can I start spraying the insects for this coming year, and what kind of insect material can I use?
Sure. So things have changed a lot in the last decade or so with respect to treating for the pests in apples, especially insect pests. We have some really great scouting tools. Days of old, we used to just spray every couple of weeks for whatever. We didn't even know what we were spraying necessarily or to kill. So now we've kind of boiled it down to a handful of key pests. That would be coddling moth, which is the worm in the apple. Apple maggot, which leaves these black specks or spots on the surface of the apple. And also plum curculio, which not everybody has. So what I'd first recommend before you spray is go online and just go, you know, apple insect pests UW Extension. You'll find some great photos of the pests themselves and the damage that they cause. And then you can, basically you're just out scouting. You're looking around. These are insects that you can see. Or with the case of apple maggot or coddling moth, there are some really nice traps, some pheromone traps that you can buy. And you hang those out, and then you'll know when they're there. And there's even thresholds now. So even if you have some pests, it still doesn't mean you have to spray. Once you exceed a certain number of pests per week that you catch, then you can spray. Now, even better, we used to just put broad-spectrum insecticides out, and we'd kill everything, which including our beneficials. Now we even have more very selective insecticides. So codling moth you can control with, say, BT, because you're controlling the caterpillar, and that's an organically approved, and it's very selective just to caterpillars. You've also then got something like spinosad to use on apple maggot or plum curculio, and you can also just live with some pest damage, right? What we tend to see is we have these spring leaf rollers that come out and chew on the foliage, and everyone gets nervous and they spray those caterpillars. They're basically harmless. The apple produces a lot of leaves, and if they lose some leaves in the spring to these leaf rollers or leaf feeding, no big deal. Just let it go. So I know it's a lot, but I really think with some attention and a little reading, we can avoid a lot of these insecticide applications that we've traditionally had to do.
All right, makes good sense. Let's take a question from the audience next.
My name is Daniel. How do you stop chipmunks from eating your strawberries?
Plant a lot of strawberries.
Have a fence that's small enough they won't get in.
Yeah, that's the trouble. And then you have to kind of L the fence a little bit because they can dig underneath. You need to sink the fence a little bit and L it out toward the where they would come, and they won't be able to dig in quite as easy.
And that's where raised bed strawberries can be handy, because you've got the walls, and then what Larry's talking about is an L, so the fence goes down along the side of the raised bed and then out away, so they can't tunnel underneath it, and then you're putting the fencing up over the top as well. And at that point, you wonder, boy, I'm spending about, you know, each strawberry is costing me $5. Why don't I just go buy a pint for a lot cheaper?
There you go. Thanks for that question. Well, we'll take, is there another question from the audience? Let's take another question from the audience. What the heck? What's your name?
Hi, my name is Amanda Arndt. I'm from Ashland, Wisconsin. And my question is we have a raised bed in the front of our house and it gets full sun. We have three Diablo nine bark tree forms. And the first year they did fabulous. The second year they had a little bit of powdery mildew, which I think it was. And the last fall they were covered. It was like it looked almost like a mold, and it's the only thing that was attacked in the garden. There was several other perennial plants, and I was wondering what could possibly do that. And then this spring they're all dead, all three of them. And it's the only thing that was attacked in that garden. So I was just curious of what you thought, or what I should replace it with, or where to go from there. Thanks.
All right, let's go to Jason Fishbach.
So it would be, well, it's too late now, but if you see it on, all the nine bark are dead?
All of them?
Okay. It most likely was powdery mildew. Powdery mildew is very species specific, so you'd have nine bark but nothing else, so that makes sense. If it was covered in kind of whitish powder, that makes sense, powdery mildew. Again, you know, I'm surprised that the whole tree is dead, or the shrub. You might see some sprouting from the base. You know, if it defoliated it heavy over a couple of years, yeah, it may have killed that top growth, but it shouldn't have killed the whole plant. So give it a little time, see if it resprouts. That said, it's just going to get it again. So you can try to preemptively treat for it, and there's some kind of homebrew fungicide treatments. If you go online, again, to our learning store, I don't have the exact mix in front of me, but you can find it's baking soda and water and that kind of thing. So you can try to treat that growth. Otherwise, I think you're right. You've got that that inoculum there, so maybe just switching species would be a good idea and avoid the nine barks at this point.
All right, and another question from the audience.
My name is Shirley Long. I'm from Marengo, Wisconsin. I have a weeping mulberry that is about 9 years old. It has a wound on it, about 12 inches long by 4 inches wide, and I'm wondering if there's any way I can stop it so it doesn't girdle the whole tree and I lose it.
So when you say it's a wound, it keeps radiating?
Mm-hmm. The bark is totally gone from it. It's on the south side of the stem of the tree.
So is this a vertical line, mm-hmm. basically?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't have much for you in that regard. I mean, that is typical. I mean, if we do get frost cracking or something happening on that south side, you know, in the spring of the year or late winter, where we get warm weather and the sap starts flowing, and then we get the sun going down. But typically, we get bark that'll start callusing underneath what was affected, but you're not seeing that, is what you're saying?
Not really. It seems okay. to be spreading.
Okay. And it seems odd that it would be spreading like that, but I don't have anything that, I mean, okay. using a paint is not a good thing. It actually inhibits the callusing process, so I guess trying to go with it.
Yeah, watch it and see what happens.
You can take a picture and send it to me or send it to our Brian Huddleston and try to get it identified. If it's a fungal or bacterial canker, there may not be much you can do about it. If it was, you know, lawnmower blight or some sun scald or something that was just a physical injury, Don's right, it should eventually callus over. But if it's spreading, it sounds like it's a biological disease of some kind. So.
Thank you.
All right, thanks very much. A listener in Menominee emailed to say my poppies haven't come up yet. Is there wondering if there's a rodent that eats the roots of poppies? Could be other reasons why the poppies aren't up yet.
Yeah, I don't know. You should, if it was something chewing, you should see some tunnels around the base of the plants. But it's such a slow year. I think just be patient and see if they do come up.
Yeah, I'd wait a bit. Yeah, let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, this is Jan. I'm from Highbridge, and I have a question for Jason. Could you update us on the hazelnut study?
Sure.
I was going to ask that question too. So
to.
Good question.
Yeah.
First, give us some background on this.
Yeah, so I'm part of what's called the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative, and this is a project to bring a commercial hazelnut industry to the Upper Midwest based on the shrub form of our American hazelnut. Hazelnuts in North America primarily grow in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. They're grown as trees. So we're looking more at a shrub-type system. We've been working to evaluate plant material that we've collected from the woods or on farm. Some of those are hybrids. And we've got it down to top 10. What we're learning is they're really hard to propagate because we want to get them out to you as soon as we possibly can, but they don't like to be propagated, so that's our slow point. But we have started to establish some regional trials with this improved material, one here in Bayfield, one down at West Madison at the research station, and then two in Iowa, two in Minnesota. At the same time, because we have growers growing a lot of seedling hazelnuts, which you can buy now, but they're seedlings, so every plant's going to be a little bit different. They need a way to process it. So just this winter, we created the Hazelnut Processing Accelerator with multiple partners here in, it's located at Northland College. And we have processing equipment now that is available for turning your hazelnuts, the in-husk material, into kernels. We're still working out the details how the general public might have access to it, but that's an important first step because you know, it's one thing to collect a handful of hazelnuts and figure out how to crack them. It's another thing when you're harvesting by the truckload. You can't do it by hand anymore. So things are moving quickly, and we're excited to get these hazelnuts out to you. And the thing that you can do, the most important thing now, is just keep eating hazelnuts. Demand hazelnuts at your stores.
There we go. Thanks very much for that question. Let's take a question from Mark in Madison next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good afternoon or morning. Quick question. I have a row of arborvitae that's probably 17 years old, and I mean, it's beautiful. There's probably 100 of them for a barrier. And all of a sudden, we started getting all these little seedlings popping up in our garden and, within 15, 20 yards of the arborvitae. Can I transplant those seedlings, which are anywhere from 2 feet to 5 feet tall, to underneath a walnut tree for a small little barrier of a plot of land that I've got? Will they grow under black walnut?
Probably not, because black walnut has juglans, and it's basically a chemical that proceeds from their root system as kind of a defense mechanism. So moving those to other places might do well, but basically under black walnuts, I don't think they'll do well at all.
Unfortunately, there's not a lot. I guess there are things that grow under black walnut, and there is a list. The UW Extension, I think, has a list of plants that will survive under a black walnut tree, if I'm not mistaken, Jason.
There is, yeah, and I don't remember arborvitae, but it sounds like those seedlings are free, so why not try a few?
You could try a couple of them and just see what happens. Why not? Right. Yeah, give it a shot. Thanks a lot. Let's take a question from the audience next.
Hi, I'm Joe Adams from Bayfield, and I'd like to understand better using muriatic acid to treat evergreens.
So would I.
That was Don Kissinger, yeah, our tree expert. It seems to work. At our farm, we used to treat all of our evergreens with muriatic acid, a dilute solution, and they would be more robust.
Okay.
Are you treating the plant itself or the soil?
The tree itself. We throw buckets of muriatic acid across the tree, and then that would obviously end up in the soil.
Must say that's the first time I've ever heard that.
I was thinking that, too. I've been doing Garden Talk a long time, and I've never heard that one.
I mean, I could see it adjusting the soil pH and potentially having an improvement on the growth of the plant, but that would be about the only thing I could think of that would have the positive impact. But
so probably what you were throwing on the tree when it hit the soil, it may have had some beneficial effect when it made it to the soil, Jason.
Potentially, you know, you'd have to do the soil test before and after to see if it actually changed it, if that was actually the driver. But, yeah, that's the only thing I could think of, but maybe someone else has a...
Somebody else may have an idea on that one. Somebody else may have done it. Let's go to Lois and Spooner next. Spooner, Wisconsin. Lois, hi.
Hi. I have a potato question this morning. This past year, our potatoes, some of them were okay, and many of them had that hollow center. It looks almost like part of a peeling or something. And then the other thing we had trouble with some of them was scab.
Okay.
So the hollow center, I have to admit, I'm not exactly sure what that is. The scab tends to be a moisture issue in the soil and can sometimes associated with too much, if there's rotted manure or something applied, the soil's a little too rich. So again, you know, potatoes like a well-drained sandy loam soil, so that's why we, in some reasons, mound it to try to get those potatoes up. So, you know, look at drainage for your garden plot to make sure that excess moisture is moving, and then just be careful if you are applying compost that it's very well rotted. The hollow center, yeah, we're going to have to punt on that one.
You know, last year I took the pile of straw that was kind of left over from my straw bale garden, and I just kind of piled it up on one end, and then I had some of these purple potatoes, and I got the seed, you know, cut them up and just threw them in the straw kind of underneath, and I got a nice batch of potatoes out of that. Yeah. I didn't have to dig anything or just, you know, kind of lift the straw up and throw them in and hope for the best, and it worked out.
If you have heavy clay soil, that's sometimes the best way to grow them. Just plant them very shallow and then just pile on the straw. Older straw works better, and yeah, it works great.
Yeah, this is a straw that was served the year before as in my straw bale gardens, and so there, you know, it's already pretty far along in terms of... you know, it's lifespan, let's say, and it's got a lot of nutrients in it. So that's what I did. Thank you very much for that question. And tell you what, we need to take a little break here because it's that time. I'm Larry Mueller with my guests today, Jason Fischbach and Don Kissinger, broadcasting to kick off Bayfield in Bloom from the Bayfield Pavilion, Bayfield, Wisconsin. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we broadcast from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, on the shores of beautiful Lake Superior to kick off Bayfield in Bloom with our two guests, Jason Fischbach, UW Extension Ag Agent, from Ashland and Bayfield counties. He works for those two counties. Don Kissinger, Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Questions, we're covering a broad range of things here on Garden Talk. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, we're always taking questions from the audience, and I believe we have a question right now from the audience. Oh. Hi, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Donna. I'm from Ashland. And I just wanted to make just a couple of comments. based on what we've heard already. I wanted to let Jason know that we do have other plants flowering in Ashland, even though the ice just went out of the bay. We have some beautiful pulmonaria, also known as lungwort. It's a raspberry color, and it's blooming in Pearson Plaza, along with the little trout lilies, and they're just coming up. And the service berries, which were mentioned earlier as a nice native for attracting birds, those will be blossoming very, very soon, if not already. And we do have nearly all the plants that Jason mentioned, that and the native shrubs that attract birds. We have nearly all of those in Pearson Plaza in Ashland, which is right near the City Hall. It's between Main Street and US 2, Lakeshore Drive. And we're hoping we can get people to stop by there and see all our beautiful plants. And I want to recognize our what we call our major benefactors, the Collinses, Jim and Joanne, because they have donated from Bayfield, they've donated many plants to our beautiful park. And also, I know you mentioned Rob from Dragonfly, and we were so sad to hear that he had passed away, because almost all our native grasses that we have at Pearson Plaza, we bought from Dragonfly. And I also just want to give a shout out to our other nurseries around here, Hauser's, where we buy many of our plants, Earth Sense, Country Blossoms, and also Rick Rules and Cable. We have some wonderful nurseries here. And we are also growing hazelnuts in Pearson Plaza. And we do have other gardens in Ashland that are beautiful to visit, Ellis Avenue, Bayview Park. Our beautification council does a fabulous job. Who did I forget? Oh, and we have, I'm glad one of our members mentioned, we also have about 50 blueberry plants in Pearson Plaza, and so residents of Ashland can stop by and pick blueberries as they wander through the park when they're ready. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful information there, Jason. And you were aware of that.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, I neglected all of our woodland ephemerals are starting to bloom or are already blooming. It's a great time to get out into the national forest and take a hike, especially this weekend here as it warms up.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. Let's take another call. Clarence in East Troy's been waiting a bit, so let's go to Clarence. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello?
Hi, Clarence. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I really like your show. It's very interesting. I learn a lot from it, so I appreciated you having that show on. But I have a plum tree. I planted last year, and these Japanese beetles, they get on there. They, for some reason, really love this plum tree. And I sprayed them with an organic spray, but it doesn't seem to help. They're just terrible. So I wonder, what could I do? Cover it with something, or is there something better to use on that to kill them things? I've been squishing them by hand, but that takes forever.
Yeah.
Well, the best thing you could do is move up here to the north where we don't have Japanese beetles. But unfortunately, that's a terrible pest. And, treating for it doesn't really, it works very short term because these things fly a long way and they'll just keep coming back and back. So, yeah, if it's a small planting or a couple of plants, putting the exclusion netting over the plant and fastening it to the base can help. Otherwise, those leaves are just going to keep getting skeletonized, and eventually it's going to weaken the tree. Some years are worse than others, and it's just a matter of, if you're really close to big lawns or golf courses, then you're going to have to look at plants that aren't quite as preferred as others for the Japanese beetles. But it's a hard one. There's no good answer, unfortunately.
They do tend to cycle a little bit. They tend to hit a big peak, and then suddenly you're not seeing as many, and they kind of, and then maybe a few years later they come back. A lot of it, I think, depends on the weather, winter weather and spring weather as well.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's take another question from a caller, Claire in Sauk County. We'll go to you now.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Bayfield.
Hi, Claire.
Hi. I have several of these cute little Dutchman's breeches plants blooming right now, and they're ephemeral. Once they're done blooming, those leaves just disappear. So a couple questions for your experts, Larry. One, do they spread by rhizome or can I them? And if so, is this time?
I think, you're breaking up, Claire, but I think she was asking, do Dutchman's breeches spread by a seed? And can you safely transplant them? How do they spread?
I don't know exactly, but for sure they could be transplanted after they've bloomed and the leaves have died. Kind of, mark the spot where they are when they're blooming, so that when the leaves die, you can find them. Then you can dig them up, spread them around, and replant them to do it that way. I don't know that I'm sure they spread by seed, but I'm not sure I've seen it in action. But yeah.
All right, there we go. I think we have a question from the audience again, so let's go there. Hi, what's your name?
My name is Susan, and I'm from the town of Washburn. I just want to put a plug in for bees and other pollinators. Without bees, there would be no gardens. And so just wanting to remind people that supporting your local beekeepers by buying their honey at your farmers market's a great way to keep people able to continue struggling against the pressures on beekeepers and bees themselves to keep them alive. And one other thing, as far as early spring food for bees and other pollinators, is don't mow your dandelions when you first see them coming up. That's one of the first nectar sources for bees up north. And mow around them if you have to. They're yellow, they're pretty. The bees love them, so take care of the bees, and the bees will take care of your gardens.
Yeah, frankly, Creeping Charlie is one of the first bloomers, and so it's a beneficial plant for really early in the spring. Those are the first things that were flowering in my lawn, for sure. Thank you for those comments, and you guys agree with that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're getting nodding of head there. Let's take another question from the audience.
Thank you. I'm Diana from Bayfield, and I grow my flowers in a container garden, and I love lilies. And my question is, can I grow the tall oriental lilies in containers? Because I haven't had very good luck with them before.
Yeah, you certainly can. It's the larger the container, the better. And trying to protect those containers over the winter. You could even dig out the bulbs themselves and replant, but trying to protect them and insulate them, cover the containers in straw, bring them into even the garage. Somehow you're just trying to avoid those, 30 below nights where it sits there and freezes solid. That's really the only reason you're going to lose those is just winter injury.
I planted a few of those just for fun, and I got some that were over 6 feet, 6 footers. They're really, really pretty. I really enjoy those. But not in pots, actually in the little space between the sidewalk and the road. We put some in, and they look really, really quite nice late in the season. Let's take a call again and go to Orfordville next, and let's talk to Roy. Roy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. Good morning. Just
morning.
A question on Darden's recommendation. For 10 years or longer, I've been trying to grow stuff out in my backyard. It's very sandy soil, a lot of shade. I've mixed potting soil in and tried to do some raised beds. Carrots won't grow. They come out looking like toothpicks. Tomato plants are pointless. They grow up but never produce fruit. And I've had some limited success with beans. Corn doesn't do anything. Any suggestions of what might grow better in sandy soil that's got a lot of shade?
Sandy soil with a lot of shade. Oof.
Yeah, that's a winning combination.
Yeah.
A lot of shade-tolerant flowers, if you wanted to go that route, would be an option that can handle that even things like, ferns, columbine, Solomon's seal, stilbe. But if you're looking for vegetables, well, there's not much that's going to handle shade. And you could try some of the leafy greens during the summer. Spinach, chard, even some kale will handle some shade. Spinach in particular won't bolt quite as fast in the shade. You're going to have to keep amending that soil. Other than that, there's come back to currants. They can handle clay or sand, and they'll actually do okay in shade. You'll often find currants growing wild under partial shade. And do just fine. So other than that, it's, you know, trying to find a spot with some sun.
Thanks very much for that question and call. You know, before I forget about it, there's always a lot of people when we do a show like this. There are always a lot of people involved in putting something like this together. And I wanted to take just a quick minute to talk about our regional manager, Paul Danberg, John Talcott, our engineer who sets this up every year. We've got Tammy Garcia, Brittany Williams back in Madison, Aubrey Ralph, Jane Rotunda, Dave Potratz, Jason Fishbach, and then Chris Molina, of course, and Don Kissinger. And I sort of come along for the ride and get to talk once in a while and have a good time doing it. But it's always a lot of fun to be in Bayfield, a group of people who are very committed to their gardens and to their flowers. And it's fun to be here, and it's fun to see all of the events that are coming up during this month of Bayfield in Bloom. I mentioned a few of them earlier, and I certainly didn't mention all of them, and I'm just looking at some papers now to see where I put the one piece of paper that I wanted to talk about here right at this moment. But I tell you what, go online to Bayfield in Bloom. If you put that in your search engine, you're going to find out all that's going on here in Bayfield during Bayfield in Bloom. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we broadcast from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, to kick off Bayfield in Bloom. I was talking earlier about Bayfield in Bloom, and I was saying, oh, just go to the Bayfield in Bloom website, and you'll find out everything you need to know. Actually, I'm told that it's bayfield.org or bayfield.org. That's where you're going to find out everything that's going on during not only May for Bayfield and Bloom, but for the rest of the year as well. Taking your questions, we're covering the whole gamut here. We've talked flowers and shrubs and trees. One thing before we go back to the questions from the audience and your calls, I did want to bring something up about spinach, because we really haven't talked anything at all about vegetables and things in that area. And I know that Jason Fishbach has a spinach project, isn't it, Jason?
Yeah, so we just wrapped up a really exciting two-year project with winter-grown spinach. There's been a real change in the way people garden, farm, with these high-tunnel, unheated greenhouses. We planted spinach in September, October, November, and we just had our last harvest about a week ago in these high-tunnel greenhouses. So we're picking spinach all winter long with no added heat in these high tunnel greenhouses. So, a couple of things. Not every gardener is going to have a high tunnel, but you can be a spinach eater all winter long. And with all these growers with these commercial high tunnel greenhouses, it's a great opportunity for them. And what we try to do with extension is to assist our agricultural economy, and giving them an opportunity to grow a crop over the winter with no added heat is a big deal, because there's so many of these greenhouses. Now what we need is eaters to learn to love this spinach. And it's a different kind of spinach than you're used to eating. It's a darker leaf. It's thicker, and everyone tells you it tastes better than any spinach you've ever had before. So we did this research over the last 2 years, learned a lot of great stuff, found some varieties. Corvair seems to be the winning variety, and so we expect to see a lot more winter spinach production happening statewide. And really, what you can do to help is find those growers and ask for spinach during the winter months. We're seeing some of these winter spinach CSAs popping up. Great, healthy. It's one of those super vegetables, and it tastes great too. So it's a kind of exciting project that we just wrapped up, and I love talking about it.
Love it. Well, from the spinach project, we're going to go to an audience member.
Hello.
Hi,
I'm Bob from town of Washburn, and I just finished up bottling and labeling some maple syrup, and then I was comparing notes online here and there, and I was finding some maple syrup products labeled as organic. and I can't imagine how you could achieve a non-organic maple syrup. But so I'm curious about what the answer to that would be.
Well, it may be that some of those sugar bushes just decided to do a little extra marketing, would be my guess. Jason, what do you think? Or Don?
I think it's just like a lot of products that they are now calling gluten-free, and they were always gluten-free, and now they're just stating it. So, you know, I think it's just a marketing tool. That's all it is.
Did you bring any of that maple syrup with you?
As a matter of fact, I did, but I'll have to go out to my truck.
Okay, there we go. Let's see. I've lost my screen, so I have no idea who's on the phone here. So I'm going to ask another question of these guys. Planting flowers, somebody asked me. You know, I want to plant some flowers right now. Can I plant some flowers right now out there? And I said, well, probably. What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, for sure. So this time of year in May, right, we have to worry about frost. So you've got to choose the right varieties. And, you know, what's better than going into a commercial greenhouse or a nursery this time of year, right? I mean, it's awesome to see all these things in full bloom. It's awesome to see all the different varieties. And the folks that run those nurseries know so much. And so really, to me, the first thing to do if you're new to planting flowers and want to plant is just go have a chat with the staff at those nurseries and tell them what your soils are like, what kind of shade you have, and ask them for some recommendations. You know, how much work do you want to do? What kind of maintenance is involved with those plantings? To me, that's really the best way to go about it. Garden Talk listeners are so well informed and educated, and we know, especially on pollinator habitat, which is an important part of people's planning, is a continuous bloom all the way through the year. And those nurseries can help you pick out what's spring flowering, early summer, midsummer, late summer, fall flowering. And you're just trying to have that whole mix.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's take a question from Jim in Elm Grove, has been waiting a bit. Jim, thanks for waiting.
Thanks for taking the call, Larry. This is a question about a very old redbud tree that we have that's very prominent in our front yard in Elm Grove. And it's got mostly healthy limbs, but there's one that is lowering itself to the ground every year closer and closer. Now it's about 4 inches off the ground, maybe 6 inches in diameter. And it doesn't have any buds on it, and we're thinking we should probably cut that off. But we're wondering if now is a good time to do it, as it's just starting, as the whole tree is just starting to bud, these wonderful red buds that we have, or is there a different time of year that's more healthy for the overall tree to do it later?
So typically...
Yeah, what do you think, Don Kissinger?
Okay, typically rule of thumb is when the tree is beginning to leaf out or bud out or flowering, we want to not be pruning. So waiting until midsummer would be an okay time, or waiting until after the leaves have dropped. I'm interested to find out, you're saying the limbs are lowering. So is this a multi-stemmed red bud that you have there?
Yeah,
it's one of the trunks?
Five, and it's just one of them is gradually lowering to the close to the ground.
Okay. Yeah, so removing that one really trunk, because it's multi-trunked, is not going to affect it in a detrimental manner. But I would probably wait, you know, probably 3 weeks ago is when you could have, you know, last removed that limb. I would wait until midsummer or after the leaves have dropped.
There you go. Thanks so much for calling. Let's take another question from the audience. Hi.
My name is Chris, and I'm from Superior, and I'm looking into getting an American hazelnut for my backyard, and I'm downtown Superior. What are some of my requirements? I have clay soil, too. Mm-hmm.
Definitely full sun. That's key for hazelnuts. They need full sun. Clay soil, they don't do quite as well, but it's a very widely adapted species, and you'll see it on clay, you'll see it on sand. So a little bit of amending if you need to, with some potting soil or compost or sand if you have it. Other than that, you know, American hazelnuts, they're, as far as I know, are no improved clonal varieties. So you're just buying a seedling from somewhere. And, you know, you're going to see some difference across the species or within the species and nut harvest or nut size or volume of nuts. But basically, they're pretty similar range. So
will she get nuts?
Well, it'll produce nuts and then the squirrels will get nuts, but probably not you.
Okay.
It's really hard with one or two shrubs. If you're not on it, the way I know when to harvest is when the blue jays show up. As soon as you see a blue jay in your, then you know they're ripe.
They're always in my compost. Yeah.
They really do. The varmints do wait until the hazelnuts are ripe. But if you're gone that week, you're out of luck. They're all eaten.
Okay.
They're gone.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Cross Plains next and talk to Lee. Lee, hello. Thank you for calling. Lee, are you there? Might have lost Lee. Let's take a question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Rose, and we live in down by Cable, Wisconsin, on a lake down there. And it's an odd time of year to think about this, but we don't always rake all of our leaves, and our property is mostly hardwood, so we do get a lot of leaf litter. How often should we rake out? Our property kind of undulates, too, because of old logs or whatever was under it. And we do have a fair number of some ephemerals, but there's some areas I just wonder, how often should I leave the leaf there? How often should I rake it up?
If you don't need to rake it, don't rake it, right? So there's that creates that really valuable duff layer that the spring ephemerals require. So if you just leave them. Now, if you're trying to grow some grass in smaller areas or flower beds, then it makes sense to remove some of them or mulch them or chop them up, right? Otherwise, yeah, in the woods, just leave them. There's no reason to rake them up.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot. Plus, there's a lot of beneficials that kind of stay late into the, you know, they're there under those leaves for a long time. And if there are areas, even if you're going to pull some out, you know, wait till it gets warm before you do it, and you'll be saving some beneficial insects, probably. Let's take another question from the audience. And you are?
Sylvia Whalen from Ashland. And I have a question. I have a huge, like, probably 120-foot maple tree really close to my house. It leans towards my house because there used to be another huge maple tree there, so it's always leaned. But that big storm 2 years ago, I lost so many trees in my yard. And my concern is this tree in the heavy winds lately has been creaking really bad. So I was out there and I checked it and I see a split down the middle. And it's not real deep, it's mostly just the thick bark in the tree. But it's making a lot of noise, and it isn't just branches because it's lost a lot of branches. And a friend of mine who works in the tree business says he has a big drill because if it splits, it's going to go east and west, not north and south, which is on the roof to my house. But he has this big drill, and he says I could drill this. He would come and drill this big hole and put a bolt in there with some kind of nuts or whatever on each end, and I've never heard of that. Is that a good idea, and is that really going to do any good?
Well, it's hard to answer the question without seeing the trees there, but typically if you're going to bolt the tree and you bolt it in two places below, you also have to cable the tree. And cabling it is up in the lower, in the upper limbs, you're actually going to have wire. And there's polypropylene or, you know, something that you can wrap around the limbs, but it's kind of like a spider web type situation. So just bolting the tree at the lower trunk and not cabling it will serve no useful purpose. You need to have both done. And even if you do both, that isn't a guarantee that the tree is not going to go.
But I've seen it done. I have friends who have done just exactly what you described, Don, and did have some success. And, it's worth a try.
Yeah, and certified arborists will do that, and that's what we will do. We will not just do one. We will not just do cabling or bolting. You need to do both in order to take care of the situation the best you can.
All right. Thanks very much for that question. Let's go to Sturgeon Bay and talk with Stella next. Hi, Stella.
Hi.
I just wanted to offer four very simple solutions to the gentleman who called in and was having trouble growing things in his sandy soil. First of all, is straw bale gardening, which is frequently discussed on your show, Larry. Or lasagna
gardening. It ran through my mind as he was talking. Oh, lasagna gardening, yeah.
Yeah, both of which will rot down and improve the soil. A third option could be raised beds, where you make your own soil. And the third and the fourth is an old farmer's aphorism that my husband came up with as I was making the other suggestions, which is add sand to clay, throw money away, add clay to sand, money in hand.
Ah.
In other words, if you do it the wrong way, you turn it into concrete. If you do it the right way, you improve the soil.
There you go. Four good tips. Thanks, Della.
You're welcome.
Appreciate
very much.
That call. Well, let's take another call while we're at it. Go to Whitefish Bay next and talk with Suzanne. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello? Hello?
Hi, Suzanne. What's on your mind?
Well, I have this Russian sage plant, which always grows unruly, long, long stems. And right now, I did not cut it down last year, you know, in the fall. And so now I'm looking at this large, long growth I don't want to see repeated. My question for the plant expert is, if I cut it down now, what do I do about pruning it now? It's so unruly. It doesn't grow up straight. It just spreads out like an octopus, but many more arms.
Yeah.
And so I want to know, what do I do now so that I don't have this happening here? The plant faces east, and it gets sun from clearly, I would say, 11 o'clock on through, I would say, 1 o'clock. It just overhead. It's there's a big tree above it, and it gets what do we call that? High canopy sun exposure. It's got a lot of sun there.
Kind of dappled. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you guys think, Jason? Let's go to
sure.
you.
Sure. Well, the other adage is prune when your pruners are sharp, and it's prune any time of the year is a good time to prune. Sort of, right?
So
it's all about kind of risk management. So let's talk about pruning. So if you prune in the winter or in the dormant season, that's usually the best because it minimizes your chance of disease spreading to those wounds, right? But just because you prune during the growing season doesn't mean you're going to get disease. It just increases the chance. So if there's other reasons that outweigh that risk, then go ahead and prune it if you just don't like the way it looks, but recognize you're taking a risk. The other one is how it affects flowering. And if you prune off all your flower buds in the spring, then you're not going to have flowers that year, right? So if it's bearing on old wood or last year's wood, then you wouldn't want to prune until after they flower. But if you just can't stand the sight of that, what I'm trying to say is if you just can't stand the sight of that plant, then go ahead and prune it and just recognize you're taking some risks that you have to live with.
There we go. Thank you, Suzanne. Appreciate it. And Mary in Sun Prairie, your turn.
Hi, good afternoon. I am enjoying this show a lot, and my question is, I have quite a few pine trees on my property, and I was wondering what kind of plants I could plant under the pine trees.
Okay, plants that go well under pine trees, so obviously we're talking about a lot of shade, and some ground cover, there may be some ground cover plants that would work there, I think.
Yeah, are they? Do you know the soil type? Are they white pine, red pine, jack pine? Gives us some clue of the soil type.
I'm not really sure. All I know is there are pine trees.
Okay, is sandy soil?
Name of, pardon?
Sandy soil.
No, regular soil.
Okay, all right. Well, it gives you more options that way. You know, it's always hard to think of these plant names, but something like Dirvella. Northern bush honeysuckle, not the invasive stuff, but Dirvella, it's fairly deer resistant, tends to grow decent in the shade, and you can plant that. It produces some smaller yellow flowers with some reddish foliage. But generally, you know, not knowing where you are necessarily, your specific conditions, I think this is a, it's going to sound like I'm punting when I am, but is to talk to your local nursery, because they know your local conditions. You can better describe the soils that you have, and they'll help you pick out specific plants for that situation.
Here in Sun Prairie, there's some great nurseries nearby. We go, you know, a place like Klein's Nursery, and just in, on the edge of Madison would be a place to go, for example. But there are many places. I always like the local nurseries, because they know pretty much what's going on in your area. So thank you very much for that call. And Jeanette, do you have a quick question for us? In Madison, sorry. I think we lost Jeanette. She was wondering about apple and pear trees. They're dying, advice for that. It's always hard to tell something like that. I think one of the best things you can do if you've got that kind of situation is something that Jason mentioned earlier, which is to get some good, you can get some good photos, and you can also get some specimens. Photos you could send to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison. And if you've got some specimens, typically they want something that's not completely gone, you know, maybe halfway through that process, and then they can do a pretty good job of telling you what kind of problem you've got and then offer some suggestions. And typically it's a pretty, there's a small fee usually associated with it, but it isn't very much, $10 or something.
Yeah, a great place to start is your local county extension agent, because they've encountered all kinds of disease problems over the years and might be able to diagnose it without you having to send in a sample. Typically we just do that when we for sure don't know what it is.
Yeah, all right, there we go. And we have time for a quick question from the audience.
My name is Lois, and we have trouble growing radishes and carrots. The raspberries do really well in this kind of soil, and some flowers do really well, but we cannot, we get beautiful green growth on it, but no radishes and no carrots.
Are you seeing, you're not getting any carrot or radish formation, or do you get little holes and tunnels in them?
Sorry, I didn't hear what he said.
I think
Maybe I'll answer both, right? So one of the problems we'll have with carrots and radishes is the root maggots, where they're little flies that lay their eggs near the developing plant, and as the roots start to grow and swell, the maggots themselves, the fly larvae, will tunnel into the... So we see that a lot, especially the later you plant, the more likely you see it. So the solution is to try to exclude the flies. So using row cover over it after you've planted, and then rotate so you make sure you don't plant in the same spot the next year. If you're not getting formation of the roots at all, I would suspect either some form of a nutrient deficiency or lack of watering or something else that's going on that's not long.
We're going to solve the problem there. Well, we are out of time. I want to thank everybody who came today here from Bayfield, and I want to thank all the folks who helped today. It's been wonderful. Our guests today, Don Kissinger and Jason Fischbach. And go to bayfield.org and take a look at all the good things going on here. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk.